Hi, this is Jim Martin from America Magazine. I'm the culture editor here, and I am with Susan Thistlethwaite. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Jim. Yes, I'm professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary. I'm also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I write a weekly column for the Washington Post, and actually, starting in January, we'll have my own column called The God Debates.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
That's great. So we were going to talk about Christmas today.
Yes.
I assume you're pro, right?
Pro Christmas? Ask me, 10, 11 o'clock Christmas Eve when I'm wrapping stuff. Yes, but normally I'd like it to be a religious holiday, though, and it's looking grimmer and grimmer for us to keep Christmas as a religious holiday. It's now a political football.
Yeah, what do you mean by political football? You mean the whole war on Christmas?
Yes, this is a pseudo issue. It has absolutely no relevance to everything and anything. And I think the reason it comes up is so that conservatives can provoke people to feel angry and oppressed who are actually members of the dominant culture, and then get them to think about that rather than ratify the START Treaty, for example, which might actually keep us from losing a major American city if nuclear proliferation gets out of control and a non-state actor or a terrorist group gets fissionable material and sets it off. But let's, why not instead talk about whether you should say Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas? Because that's clearly a crucial issue for the American public. So it's like, don't look at this hand here because this hand is the culture hand and this hand over here is what might actually get you killed or what might actually get you a job if we want to name other lame duck things.
Yeah, no, I'll provoke you a bit though. I agree with you. I think that it is sort of ginned up, and I think your point about I've always thought it's interesting that the affluent are somehow convincing the poor and the middle class that what they're purporting is in their best interests, which I think is kind of an interesting trick. But I would say that I think that there are some people who feel that not that there's a war on Christmas, but that the sort of increasing commercialism and the sort of use of Christian imagery and one of my favorite examples is Macy's. I live right up the street from Macy's in New York, and they have a huge sign that says "Believe," and I thought, oh, for Pete's sakes, so this sort of hijacking of religious imagery, while obviously doesn't raise to the sort of moral status of a war, I think is kind of frustrating for people. And to your point, I think it can make it harder for people to feel like they're trying to live a religious holiday.
Yes, oh, definitely. And what they mean is believe in the free market. They just,
Oh,
kind of
sure.
left the rest of that out. Indeed, that is their faith. And they want you to believe in it and come shop
Yeah,
at
I'd even
Macy's.
say believe in shopping.
Yes, absolutely.
But I do find it interesting. For me, I did a piece in Huffington Post, saying that I find sort of sociologically interesting the way that they are able to use the images and use, red and green and, the word Mary and joy and peace and Santa and, almost everything else without ever mentioning the word Christmas. And I always want to say, just come right out and say it. I don't think they're going to offend too many people by saying it. But I too, I mean, I share your, I sometimes think we all have to embrace our inner Scrooge during Christmas because I think that, a little distance from the kind of excess. I think is healthy for everybody. And I frankly, as a Christian, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a non-Christian during Christmas. I think it'd probably be even worse, to have this sort of tsunami of ads coming over you.
Yes, no, I know Jewish friends, Muslim friends feel the same way, and of course their kids feel left out. Hanukkah is celebrated by the Jewish community. I think that I wrote a piece for the Washington Post on the difference between Jesus and Santa Claus, and
Oh, I read that. It was very good.
it was based
Yeah,
on.
Jesus forgives you. Wasn't that your point? But Santa doesn't.
Well, that was my nearly 4-year-old. Really, this is a true story. I was preaching before I got my PhD. I was a local church pastor. I'm doing the children's sermon. My own child is standing there with his blankie, and I asked the children, what's the difference between Jesus and Santa Claus? And my baby Bill said, well, Jesus will forgive you and Santa Claus never will. And Billy had always hated that. You better watch out. You better not cry. And, you know, Santa's coming and it's a threat because if you're not good, you're going to get nothing. And so he hated Santa Claus. And I think a lot of what we have is not actually Christian theology now around Christmas, but Santa theology, which is the gift giving and the threat level of, you know, better, you better buy at Macy's or buy anyplace else. Last year, I actually wrote a piece on a very, very sad thing about a man, a worker in a Walmart, I think it was a Walmart, that they were having their early morning specials, beginning of the Christmas shopping season, and they crashed through the door, and this man was killed by the shoppers trampling over him. And they, you know, shopped him to death. So it was enormously tragic. So, you know, there are aspects of it that are funny, but there are aspects of it that are not the slightest bit funny.
And well, I mean, I think that whole Black Friday thing is insidious. And I think it also plays on, mostly it's the poor, you know, who are sort of lining up for these deals. And the idea, frankly, of making people get up at 3 in the morning, you know, the day after Thanksgiving, you know, in order to shop. And the fact that the marketers are sort of, you know, revving people up. You know, I'd say it's not only Santa theology, it's sort of Adam Smith theology. I speak as someone who went to Wharton before I entered the Jesuits. I should have said I'm a Jesuit priest at the beginning of the discussion. But I also think, you know, more and more when I talk to parishioners, they feel this pressure to, you know, to buy more in order to prove their love to people, which I think is really unfortunate. So the notion that you know, if I get someone 5 presents, it means I love them more than if I get them 4 presents. And so there's this huge stress. I was talking to someone the other day who has 75 gifts to buy, you know, for Christmas. And, you know, and she's a Christian. And Christmas for her, and I think for people, you know, in her situation, becomes something to dread. And I've always thought that, you know, if we could get Christmas more like Easter, you know, I mean, no one complains about, you know, stress during Lent or, you know, Good Friday sales or, you know, having to go to, you know, Holy Thursday, you know, sales at Macy's. So I feel that in a sense that the stress sort of sociologically and culturally prevents people from entering into the season, you know, even Christians. So that by the time Christmas Eve comes or Christmas Day, I was speaking about this last night with a friend who's a parish priest, people are just completely worn out. People are just collapsed and they sort of roll into mass or services or wherever. And, you know, it's very hard for them to actually listen to the readings and appreciate the religious import of what's going on because they've spent, you know, the last 2 weeks at Barnes and Nobles or Macy's, not to pick on Macy's.
Yeah. Well, you know, I substantively agree with you. I think that you have to make better individual choices, but the larger issue is really now this is we've lost this holiday as Christians. It has been taken over as an engine of putting the economy into the black. I mean, it's what Black Friday means. And I wrote a book, published it this fall called Dreaming of Eden, American Religion and Politics in a Wired World. And I'm looking at Adam and Eve and, in fact, the internet. We've got these apples with bites out of them on our computers where I'm staring at an apple right now on the computer with a bite out of it. The internet is a source of the knowledge of good and evil. But connecting to what you said about economy, I also go on to Cain and Abel, and I have a section called Cain and Abel as Bankers. And I talk about Keynesian economics, C-A-I-N-S-I-A-N.
That's great.
Yeah.
that sounds like it's worth the price of the book.
It is. I am personally the inventor of Keynesian economics.
Keynesian economics, yeah. Right.
But, you know, people overly, I mean, Cain, right, kills Abel. Now, Abel's the shepherd. That's the agrarian, even hunter-gatherer past. And Cain, which means metal worker, he's the new technology guy. He's agriculture. And he basically, you know, cultural anthropologists tell us, so we have the settled economies of agriculture, which allow civilization to develop. And Cain, the metal worker, founds the first city in the Bible. He founds Enoch, east of Eden. And, you know, all of the stuff that we have going on here is now east of Eden. And and so Cain, in a sense, all of that, what we do in terms of civilization, to a certain extent, does some violence to our relationship with the natural order. And but you don't, you know, you've got law, you've got economy, you've got, you know, high culture, good stuff comes from the founding of civilization. But there's also war in the form that we have it now, organized war, the invention of social class and some. And this is really violence in the human condition. So Keynesian economics kind of, I thought, kind of grasped the fact that it's not innocent. This is not innocent, our economies. They do produce some stuff, but on the other hand, they actually dehumanize us in huge ways.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you know, to your point, I mean, Cain versus Abel, it's also, everything's competition. I mean, things are built in, you know, things are built on the idea of competition and getting ahead. And if there's someone that wants to get ahead, that means there needs to be someone below, you know. And I think a lot of that, you know, sort of argues for the spirituality of a simple life, the spirituality of, you know, communal good, things like that. But it's funny, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about Christmas. From a spiritual vantage point, a lot of people, as you know, it's also one-upsmanship in Christmas. It's who can get the better gift and who has the, you know, the more attractive house. I saw an incredible article in the Times this week that talked about people in New York outsourcing their Christmas decorations to stylists. So, you know, the idea that they would have a you know, like a professional interior decorator design their tree. And And, you know, it's all about one-upsmanship. And, I mean, I think, you know, the Cain versus Abel story, I think, is part of that. They, you know, one has to be better than the other. And so I think that's also insidious, too. I think people feel this, you know, this sort of social pressure to compete, which I think is terrible. I mean, you know, I have a book called The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, and I talk a little bit about downward mobility. You know, the real Christian response is downward mobility. It's sort of identification with the poor and the marginalized. And, you know, I think a lot in our culture, even at Christmas time, you know, is part of the sort of the Keynesian economics, which leads to this sort of relentless competition.
Yeah.
And I think people really feel, really beaten down by that.
And
I
anxious.
I think they just want to rest.
Yeah. Anxious and anxiety manifests itself as aggression. So, you know, what you've got, and people say we need more civility in the public square, but kind of look behind that. How much anxiety is being manifest as aggression, and how much the internet facilitates that, facilitates it hugely. And, you know, you've got this stuff coming at you. And, of course, it's sales. I you know, logged on for us to get together. And how many, besides your interesting emails about what should we talk about today on Blogging Heads, in between 25 advertisements, get this, get that. This fruit basket, you can still make it by the, you know, December 24th, and go, 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 bye, bye, bye. And, but I, you know, I, while I was waiting for you to log on, I bought something. But I bought, I bought actually 10 of them. I bought bracelets called Peace Cords. And if you go to arzurugs.org, these are bracelets made by Afghan women. And they are made out of discarded American military fabrics left behind by our troops. And a lot of parachute cord and other things. And so you can – so I bought a whole bunch of Peace Cords bracelets to give to people and to support – Afghan women developing their own economy, you know, so you can be more intentional. You know, you can send a cow, you can buy a sheep. You don't have to, you don't have to get the bells and whistles, super duper electronic thing that will do whatever you need done. You can support the world. And, you know, this is, I think, I'm hoping these Peace Corps things will catch on. And, you know, if young people got them, started wearing them on campuses and elsewhere, Afghan women need your support. So,
well, and also, you know, in terms of the latest, you know, electronic thing with the bells and whistles that you don't need, you know, you probably already have one, have something that does just as well.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I think part of the marketing culture keeps telling us that we need something bigger, something I mean, I don't know how many iPhones there are now, but you need more with different apps. And I think that's inculcated into kids very early. I saw a terrible advertisement last night. Thank God I can't remember what the marketer was, but it was a Christmas pageant. You know, if you can imagine that, the kids standing up on the stage and they were doing the regular Christmas story. And suddenly they turn into a video game, you know, to show their parents what they really want for Christmas. And I thought, you know, that comes all from the marketers. But I agree with you. I think there are a lot of ways to celebrate the holiday more simply, and live more simply. And I think people feel happy when they can do that. I think the difficulty is that they feel pressured, sometimes by their families and sometimes by neighbors or coworkers, to not do that. And so the person who actually is trying, you know, as you're trying to do, to sort of, give green gifts and give gifts that are socially responsible and socially conscious, or to just cut back in general, they're kind of like the party pooper. You know, they become the spoil sport.
Well,
Which,
too bad. You know, if you're going to be my friend, this is what you're going to get. But you know, but
right.
in the local church that we belong to for many, many years, it's illustrated this so beautifully. All right, the church council wants to buy this enormously expensive creche, you know, with a larger than life size Mary and Joseph and wise men and some sheep, and you know, it's all huge statues. And the pastor says, no, we should use this for mission. We should use this money for mission. They overrule the pastor and they buy it, and it comes. And it set it up on the lawn of the church, and oh my God, Jesus, the baby Jesus, isn't attached to the manger. So the baby Jesus is, you know, larger than life-size baby, but still very portable. And the manger is quite heavy. So what the church council wants to do is put a bolt in the butt of the baby Jesus and chain him to the manger so nobody will steal him.
Interesting
And
symbolism.
right, so the pastor preached this great sermon about, you know, I didn't want you to buy this, but you bought it anyway. And now it's an opportunity for us to
Wow.
actually experience the vulnerability of the child who came into the world in that manger. And we need to leave that vulnerable baby there in order to really get the core message of Christmas. Now, just guess, Jim, what did the church do?
Chain the baby
Chain
to
the
the
baby to the baby. In his
Well, you know,
butt,
it's
Jim.
funny,
I
Susan.
mean,
That's a
in his
great, you know,
butt.
it's also a great image because I think it also, I mean, that's a very powerful, it's like a parable.
It is.
I mean, I think the notion also that, you know, that you would want to, in a sense, we all want to have the baby Jesus and the Jesus that we want, and we want to have God where we
Chain.
want
Yeah,
him,
all right.
or
Chain him
where we
down.
want her, and we want to chain her down, and we want to chain him down, and God will not be chained down.
No, it's exactly right. I mean, you can do that with the plaster statue, but the larger, but it's, you know, it isn't,
See,
but
it's
the
funny.
bigger
I
question I was
actually,
going to
I
ask
actually.
you, though, is one of the reasons, therefore, that we have all this stuff around Christmas, is it because the actual central message of Christmas is so challenging? Do you use the stuff? I mean, is it just stuff getting in the way? Or maybe there's stuff so that we don't have to think about what it means, God with us. That's where I was going with that. And I'm suspicious that the stuff is, yeah, we can blame the marketers and so forth and so on, but people do it. And one of the reasons they do it is because it's scary, God with us, the
Yeah,
actual
the
vulnerability
incarnation
of
is
God. Yeah.
the incarnation is very scary, and the
Yeah.
incarnation, you know, as you're alluding to, is very challenging and very threatening to people. I mean, if you really believe in that, that has really profound implications, for the way you live your life. If you really believe that God became human and, as John's Gospel said, pitched his tent among us, which I love,
Yeah,
walked in our shoes.
yeah,
But it's interesting. I always think that I sometimes think that the marketers aren't that sort of conscious. I mean, I think they're basically trying to make money. And I think what happened is this. I think that Christmas, I would put a different gloss on that. I think Christmas has been turned into a holiday about giving, And most good Christians and most good people in general think that that's a good thing, which it is, right? And so Christmas is about giving and showing your love to people, which, as Jerry Seinfeld used to say, nothing wrong with that. The problem is that the giving has completely sort of overshadowed the religious meaning, of the holiday, which is, as you say, the incarnation and Christ becoming one of us. And Christ becoming, frankly, poor. I mean, the idea, it's kind of ironic that we're running out and buying, 64-inch, I don't even know how big, 64-inch, TV screens when, Christ was born in a manger, mm-hmm. In a marginalized country, in a marginalized family, in a marginalized religion.
Under a rope and under an oppressive, militaristic.
Yeah. So I think it's more that for me, I don't know if the markers are that clever to say, consciously, we're sort of anti-incarnation, but I think that the giving, if they would even understand, I don't know if Don Draper would understand that, but that the giving has sort of subsumed the religious, the theological meaning, which is, as you say, it is a mystery and it's kind of incomprehensible, and it's also frightening to people because it really requires a kind of response that I think people today might be afraid to give.
No, I'm not saying marketers are smart enough to understand that people are afraid of the mystery of the incarnation.
Yeah,
human nature finds one another.
Yeah.
All right, so that's temptation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what that is. It's why, go back to the Garden of Eden. That's temptation. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. one thing that I know markers are, they have PhDs in this, in temptation. Mm-hmm. What's going to tempt you? And how do you get people to do that?
Yeah.
But if you're, look at Jesus tempted in the wilderness, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And the devil, and it's interesting that, think about temptation. I don't smoke, okay? So you can mm-hmm. put tons of cigarettes in front of me. It's mm-hmm. not tempting. I don't want it. Right. But Godiva chocolate. Now we're going to talk. It's tempting. So the devil tempts Jesus with food because he's been fasting, but he also, his trump card is to tempt him with power. And this is always, I've always believed in the humanity of Jesus because the thing the devil tempts him with the most is power over other people. And so that's the nature of temptation. And human frailty, human nature can fall for that. And so resisting temptation, resisting that power, what are you talking about when people, I've got the best looking house here mm-hmm. on Fifth Avenue. Well, it's power, right? It's manifesting mm-hmm. your wealth, your significance in the society.
Well,
so it's power.
And the devil's tempting with security too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you could be safe. You can, you're nothing bad's going to happen to you. Stick with me.
I think the temptation these days is to say, if I have more things, I will be more secure.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the end, I mean, the things. It's funny. I actually like, from of all places, I like the movie Fight Club, where they say, your possessions end up owning you.
Yeah. No, certainly.
But it's funny in terms of the temptation. It's interesting. I think. I talk about this in the Jesuit guide that St. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits, talked about the way that, we're pulled, between two poles, good and evil and God and not God. And, I think one of the ways things works in sort of the darker side of ourselves, as you were saying, is that we can be tempted by something that seems good.
Right.
So for example, as in the temptation in the desert, there's nothing wrong with, bread or power or ego-driven nature. I mean, that's, if you sort of use them. But the same way as in terms of giving. I think that what's happened is people are more easily tempted. It's obvious. It's easy to reject something if it's false. I mean, if someone says, here's a gun, you shoot somebody. Well, that's easy to reject. It's false. But if someone says, hey, how about giving and buying things? You could say, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think I'll do that. And then you gradually get led to the point where where a lot of the people are now, which is that they're consumed with this idea of buying, and if they don't buy something, they're a bad person.
Well,
if they don't buy the best thing,
they're a bad person. Both in Catholic theology and on the Protestant theologians like us, you have lesser goods, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're choosing lesser goods, mm-hmm. and I do think that in choosing lesser goods, you lose track, you lose yourself,
sure.
you lose focus. On what makes a human life joyous. And,
right.
You're talking about people dragging themselves and, you know, and the joy to the world. We just sang that in chapel yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking to myself, when it's my absolutely favorite Christmas carol, and I was thinking to myself about the joylessness of this season, very much in the same way that you were. And we always, our big present to one another is to go away together. And so our families, my boys are, you know, in their 20s, and so everybody flies, and we go to a condo we own in Colorado. So the first times we were out there, we get into the church, you know, just picked a church at random to go to Christmas Eve services, and we sit down in the pew, and we look up, and the cross was made of skis. And so we all simultaneously stood up and walked out of the church. Yes, the cross was made of skis, two skis that were...
Wow.
You know, is the, you know, the curved tops of the skis, and then you know, the other
it's
one.
Interesting enculturation.
Yeah. Well, it was ridiculous. So we departed. But, you know, there's so much of the embeddedness even of Christianity in culture and in the culture of, in this case, resort communities. And so there was, you know, there was no joy in there. That was just, you know, welcome to this great, you know, mountain and tourist destination. So you got to be careful because there's a lot of it around. But, you know, I think the larger, the most troubling aspect of the season to me is how are we? I mean, there's a lot of people whose jobs depend. I mean, this is so insidious. On you're getting stuff,
right?
If you don't get stuff, then people who make it, and these are, you know, yes, we've got the corporate execs and so forth, but the people who make the stuff are not the wealthy. And so we really need to think, how do we reshape the economy in general?
Sure.
So that I'm not, by doing, you know, the very reduced amount of spending that I do, I'm not... throwing somebody out of work. That's an insidious system that you just can't ignore.
No, it's true. I'm smiling because you can't see me. I take a vow of poverty, so I think I can match you with the little spending. I think that, you know, the idea of, you know, buying something else at the Gap so that the CEO can, you know, walk home with more money is, I find really distasteful. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, go back to your idea of the creche. I think that what bothers me the most, in addition to the stuff you're pointing out in terms of, you know, the social justice aspect of the, you know, the capitalist system, you know, the creche would probably not bother me as much as, because you could at least make an argument that it's at least, you know, for the church and for the people of God. And, you know, what bothers me is people who really buy things that they simply do not need.
Yeah.
I mean, and children who get things that they do not need and that they do not open. I remember I worked in Kenya for 2 years with refugees, and, you know, people have heard these kinds of stories before, but, you know, in the refugee camps where I visited, and in Nairobi where I worked for a couple of years, you know, the kids would make do with one soccer ball, you know, between 10 or 15 of them. And frankly, they seemed, I mean, you know, I can't look within the hearts of the refugees or every child in the United States, but they seemed happier in terms of one another. You know, I mean, they were miserable in their poverty, but in terms of their joyfulness, as you were talking about with one another, they seemed happier than a lot of the kids today who are, you know, sort of glued to their text. Now, I'm not a Luddite or anything. I mean, here I am on
logging kids,
anyway,
right?
But it does seem that we've lost that. And, you know, to your earlier point, I think we've lost totally lost the idea that Jesus was poor.
Yes.
I don't know really how in God's name, literally, we've gotten to the point where we think that if you believe in Jesus, you will be wealthy. If you believe in Jesus, you will be successful. And that, you know, and that being Christian is sort of the stepping stone to more and more wealth and more things. I mean, I don't know how you could look at either Jesus or the early church or the lives of the saints and draw that conclusion, but I think that, too, is threatening to us. I mean, if we said that, you know, if we really understood what it meant to be born in a manger, a terrible, stinky, disgusting place, marginal place, I wonder sometimes when people are praying before the manger what they're thinking.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And as you're saying, it's not, you know, he wasn't skiing, that's for sure.
No, absolutely. The Scandinavian, this is a wonderful, you know, how cultures This is a little off the topic, but how cultures make these stories their own. And there's a wonderful Scandinavian story about Mary, and Mary's out skiing. And she skis under this berry bush, and the berries fall on her. And that's how she conceives Jesus. Mm. It's a beautiful story. I mean, it's just like, why not berries? You know, why not? But the but, you know, as you know, in following this train of thought, we had a Washington Post panel, and, you know, is giving tax cuts to the rich moral, ethical from your religious tradition? And many of the conservatives wrote, the conservative religious folks wrote, no, it's private. No, that's private. And no. That, you know, watch, you know, there where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And it's your values. It's the consummate values in the public square. But people are incredibly, I mean, you can talk about sex in the church from morning till night. People don't get nearly as upset as if you do talk about money.
And, oh, it's very threatening.
You know, and we're all cycling, we're cycling around here in this Christmas discussion with what do we do with our money? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Christmas has lost its spiritual meaning because it's become an engine of the economy. And it's not just the Gap executive. I mean, the point that I wanted to cycle back to is I'm not talking about the Gap executive. I'm talking about the person who puts the shoes in the box. I'm talking about the person. And if that's the way we have to make it go, if you can't have that person even have that lousy job, because you've got this economy that depends on, I mean, I'm thinking about, maybe we could just move Christmas. We could say, okay, you guys can have it, you know?
Oh, yeah,
you know,
I had an article, then
we'll just do something over here in February.
Yeah, well, exactly. I had an article in, I forget where, Huffington Post, I think, last year, saying that we should just say to the marketers, you know what, you've won. You can have it. Take it. You know, we're going to have something called New Christmas in June, and it'll be like Easter. And the only thing that's going to happen is people will go to church and maybe have a dinner. But, you know, I think they'd probably take that one over, too.
Well, I know we should talk, you know, just let's try to get it started. OK. And just, you know, see what we can do. The church calendars, we got a lot of work to do.
Right. There's very little going on in most churches in June. So I think it's pretty reasonable.
Yeah. But now you don't want to get it too close to the 4th of July. Or the same, you know, then. Oh, yeah. No. You know, you could cause more problems than you could solve.
You got to find some.
I mean, that's why I was suggesting February, because it's still cold. Not a lot going on in February. And I mean, you got to look around at the rest of the calendar and see what's what. But I'd
be all for that. Yeah, now, I want to come back to something you said, if you don't mind, because we emailed about this. I think it's sort of an evergreen topic, not to sort of, you know, make a pun on your story. But where do you think Mary fits into Christian spirituality? I know it's a huge question. Or people's consciousnesses these days? Because I know I've written a lot about Mary and the saints. I think that most people think of her rather than as a strong woman from Nazareth, you know, who was asked to say yes to something incredible and, you know, goes through this extremely difficult life and is a very resilient person. They think of her kind of as this kind of scrubbed 1950s housewife, you know, the best mother, the best wife, the sort of demure person. So I'm curious, as a woman, as a theologian, where you think or how you think she can fit in to people's consciousnesses these days.
Well, you know, as a liberal Protestant, Mary is not there for me in the top 25, really, theological topics. If, you know, I were to, you know, to answer that question, yeah, I'm very fond of the work of Rosemary Ruther, for example, who's done enormous work on it. I teach that work. To the Protestant students, this means very little. So I think it is a very specific to the Catholic tradition, and it has its pacifying functions. You know, I mean, you yes, you have all these children, but in truth, you know, I didn't have, at least in the first one, have sex to get them. So you know, it does demean the body, demean human sexuality. But on the other hand, as Bishop Desmond Tutu came to Chicago Theological Seminary a number of years ago now, and we gave him an honorary degree. And this was when the struggle against apartheid was going on, and or still going on. And he talked about Mary, and he said that, you know, suppose she had said no. and
Yeah, sure.
that you can, you can say no to the divine entering
Right.
the world, and then a lot of things would mess up after that. So he was talking about her actually as a figure for him, as a person initiating a liberation. So I mean,
well,
it's possible to do that. It's just, there's just nothing in my past and or my present tradition that connects to Mary in any vibrant, vital way.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, I would say that, I respect that, of course. And I would say, though, that she, I read people like Elizabeth Johnson, the Catholic theologian. And she
You'll find
book,
my,
well,
yeah, I endorse that book.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. That's right. I knew I recognized that from somewhere.
Yes, it's good stuff.
But
I'm just saying it doesn't work for me.
This notion of Mary, as you said, Mary, the one who says yes. Now, interestingly, she doesn't appeal to a man. She doesn't say, I'm going to check with Joseph or I'm going to check with my husband. She is free.
Mm-hmm.
When in that story the angel says, will you do this? She says yes. But I also think what's interesting in terms of social justice is Mary's Magnificat in Luke, where after she finds out that she's going to have a baby, she goes to her cousin Elizabeth once again, woman to woman. And says, the Lord has cast down the mighty from their thrones. I mean, it says this. I mean, you're talking about that panel you were on. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
You imagine Mary, right? This, poor woman from Nazareth standing up and saying, God will be casting the mighty from their thrones. The rich he will send away empty.
Yeah.
And the poor he will fill with good things. I mean, I think in a sense, not only for me is Mary this great model of, for me as a man, of this person who says yes to God, and who says yes freely, and I always say this, that, a lot of our spiritual life is very much like Mary. God takes the initiative. We question, Mary says, how can this be? God sort of points us to different things that have happened in our life to allow us
mm-hmm.
to say yes, the way the angel does in the story to Mary. And then we, in a sense, bring Christ into the world. And then, in a sense, sometimes, as the story has it, the angel leaves her. Sometimes we don't feel God's presence. So the arc of Mary's life in that story of the Annunciation is a great sort of spiritual moment for us. But more importantly, she is this great apostle of social justice.
Mary
is the poor
so
person
answer
who's talking
this
about
for
that.
You. No, so you answer for me.
Pardon
so
me?
How come most
how come?
Of what you drive through Chicago neighborhoods and Mary, the iconography of Mary, the role of Mary in women's lives in
mm-hmm.
these communities around Chicago is be quiet, be the good mother, don't challenge your husband. She is predominantly not the liberator in, I'm just saying broadly speaking, she's not
well, I would
the
say,
liberator.
That's a good question.
That's a good, that's a good interpretation of the text. So how come it's so pacifying?
Well, I think part of it is, for many years she was presented like that. I think before the Second Vatican Council and before, say, the 60s and 70s, she was presented like that. And so I think what you're seeing is, a residue of that culture, which still hangs on, tenaciously.
What do you mean it still hangs on? Like, it's being resurrected, reified, and strengthened again. I mean, the Second Vatican Council is so, I mourn this. But that period in the history of the church, and I mean the church universal, because it was a great period in for Protestants as well, is dead. It's over. And the reactionary forces have this is the trajectory now. So it's not like that's continuing. The reverse is the case, at least in my observation. The Catholic theology is once again in some of, I'm talking in not with the leading thinkers, but I'm talking
mm-hmm.
about in Pilsen, okay? That's
well, but,
what's
yeah.
preached. It is.
Well, but by the same token, I worked, and I know, actually, it's funny, I know Pilsen, the Jesuits have a parish.
Yeah, I know. That's why you think I brought it up.
I think, by the same token, I'll tell you a story. I would say it depends on the person. Different women have different responses, and different men have different responses to Mary. I was working in a prison once in Boston as a chaplain, and, we were going over the story of the Annunciation and the birth of Jesus in Spanish, and my Spanish was terrible. And I prepared this little, as I'm sure you're familiar with these experiences, I prepared this little mini homily. for these women inmates who were predominantly Spanish-speaking. And, I opened my mouth and gave my little sermon, and they read through the passage. We read it out loud in Spanish, and they took off for an hour and talked about Mary and how Mary understands her because they're poor. You know, Mary understands them because, she is giving birth in difficult situations, because she goes to an elder woman, for advice, because she speaks on behalf of the poor. So I guess, I mean, I agree with you. That's certainly a huge part of Catholic culture, this kind of docile, scrubbed version of Mary. But I would say, in a lot of places, she is, very subversive still, in people's hearts. And I think most preaching in Catholic churches these days has to do more with the sort of Mary the Liberator, even though some of the imagery, is really antiquated. I mean, Mary looks like she is Scandinavian. She always has, blonde hair and blue eyes. And when I was working in Africa, I asked an African craftsperson. I was working with refugees, helping them with handicrafts and, starting up small businesses. And I remembered I asked an Ethiopian if he would draw some pictures of Mary for our office, and he brought back a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, let's rethink this. So I think it's a both end. I think that there are some sort of throwbacks to the sort of the Mary that says that women should be passive and docile and quiet. But I really do think, based on my own experience with the poor and in different parishes, that the subversive Mary and Mary of Nazareth, is really someone who appeals to a lot of people. And she's a big part of my life, and I love all the new scholarship on her. I think it's just absolutely fascinating.
It makes theology so fascinating to me, because there you are. I mean, there's wonderful stuff, and I'm telling you, I mean, I have Catholic women theologian friends who've done marvelous work, and Joseph Fiorenza and Rosemary Ruther teach their work. It's just not to me. And,
sure, which is, yeah.
And so, I mean, I have always, in terms of my theology is very Christologically centered.
Desmond Tutu is... It's also not for all Catholics, too, I would say.
Yeah, Desmond Tutu is right that you don't get into Christmas unless Mary says yes. And I think that saying yes to God does require saying no to some of what the larger culture is trying to do.
Yes,
to
because
Christmas,
you know,
right?
I totally agree. I think that's a great insight, because when she says yes, she's saying yes to a very complicated and difficult life, and she's saying yes to sort of a lot of uncertainty of the future.
Right.
She's saying no to security.
Right. Yeah.
And she's saying no to the sort of norms of her day, and she's saying no to being approved by people.
Yeah. I think that's a liberation reading, and I think that, all joking aside, it's unlikely we'll move Christmas. So what do we do to subvert it?
Say that again. It's unlikely to...
That we'll be able to move Christmas. You want to do it. We're a party of two here.
You mean you and me together?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
It's funny. I feel that, I've been telling people, and I did this piece for HuffPo, that the war on Christmas, so-called, is lost, and that the marketers, as we've agreed, have sort of won it. And I think, there's this new regime in place, now that has won the war, the marketers. And so I think it's time to engage in some passive resistance.
Well, I wish I thought what you wrote really was behind the war on Christmas, because I don't. I think it's simply a pseudo-issue created by political conservatives who want to distract people, number one, from the issues in front of them that actually affect their lives, and number two, to make Christians feel like they're a threatened minority. It's incredibly hostile response to Muslims, to Jews, to Buddhists, to Sikhs, to all the other religious diversity in our society.
Right.
And so both in terms of a rejection of religious pluralism, and in terms of pay no attention to the fact that you're not ratifying a nuclear weapons treaty that every single state secretary of state still living says, do it. Don't be stupid. No. Well, let's worry about whether somebody says happy holidays to you or Merry Christmas. I wish you were right, Jim, but I think the people behind the war on Christmas because they're trying to get you to pay attention to something that nobody needs to pay any attention to
now,
whatsoever.
I agree with you. I think you were that's not what I was saying. What I was saying was that what we were agreeing on in terms of, you know, marketing sort of subsuming Christmas, that's more.
Yeah, no, and we agree on that. I mean, I'm saying I wish that's all the war on Christmas was, because
I agree. And I agree. I think part of it is this sort of victimization of people. And false victimization. But I guess the point is that in you know, however it's happening or whyever it's happening, and I would agree with you on some of those reasons, most of those reasons, it is the case that, you know, people feel overwhelmed by this sort of tsunami of consumerism. And I think that has won out, basically.
Yeah,
that has swept it all away. And sort of living in this new world, what can you do? You cannot, you know, I've written articles for the last couple of years, you know, saying, oh, we have to fight against it. And I think that, you know, people feel so powerless. And so now I think it's time for some passive resistance. I think, you know, sort of consciously cutting back, you know, keeping things simple, you know, choosing, you know, actually not to buy as many presents, not to go to as many holiday parties, you know, not to bake up a storm, not to decorate your house, you know, till 12 o'clock at night, not to shop until you drop, not to go to Black Friday, and actually saying no. I mean, I think, you know, as you were saying about Mary, saying yes means saying no. I think saying no means saying yes. Saying no to a lot of that, you know, ridiculous excess means saying yes to something that's more sane.
Yeah.
And I think, frankly, people just are happier when they're doing less during the season. It gives them the space, the sort of contemplative space, to enter into something resembling, you know, a religious holiday.
We did that years ago. I mean, decades ago. And I think children have continued that in their own family lives now, the grandchildren. And, you know, every ornament on our tree is handmade. We've made them over the years. And so we decorate the tree together as a family, and we take each one out. Remember when you made this one, you know, it's a four-year-old sort of thing, you know, but the tree is great. I mean, it doesn't look great, but it's great. And it's a family ritual, getting those family rituals back.
Beautiful.
And then, you know, we get people individual gifts, but then we also do this charitable giving, as I've said, and to just, you know, celebrate the person that we're giving the gift to, because that's a person, and, you know, I'm as proud of my kids as I can be. They are people who volunteer for the homeless. They're people who do enormous amount of their own desire to heal the world. So, you know, this, and we think about matching the person with the charity, and, you know, that's a form of giving that can be quite spiritual. My husband is a physician, and I'll tell you what he did, and brag on him, because he, you know how many doctors give each other boobs, right? Nothing. And my husband is not into that. So what he did was he set up a fund for nurses to get extra training. And so every year he gives some money into this fund, and the nurses, and he gives it in the name of all the doctors. And he sends them a note saying, here you go. This is our gift, and my gift to you is to help these nurses get some training. So then the nurses can go to the fund, which is administered by the hospital. And then if they want to go to the seminar on how can I learn to use this particular machine so that I can upgrade myself at the hospital and I can do better service to there's some money there for them to use it. And so how much better is that than getting yet another bottle of scotch, which we just stick in the cabinet? Yeah. So, you can be more creative, and people like it. People like it a whole lot. And so I think the spirit of giving is one of the things you and I are also saying. The spirit of giving has been lost to stuff. And to say, no, stuff.
Well,
let's think about actual giving. What does that mean?
And exactly, actual giving, and, you know, and remembering the person who gave of himself, and, you know, God who gives of himself and herself. Now, speaking of saying no, I see that our time is getting a little long.
Well, it just, you know, it went like that. I enjoy this very much. I enjoy this very much. And
I did too, Susan. And I wish you a Merry Christmas. And it's great. I hope to meet one day.
Merry Christmas, peace on earth, and goodwill to all.
Amen.
Bye.